I'm going to call this meeting in order of the Stanislaus County Board of Supervisors for August 26, 2014. Please rise for a pledge of allegiance to our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we do not have any presentations this morning. We will move to public comment. This is the time that our audience can speak to the board about any item that is not on today's agenda. If you'd like to speak an agenda item, you will have to wait until that item comes up. I have two requests, actually one request to speak for public comment, and that is Gary Dosico. I'm not sure if I pronounced that properly or the best I could.
My name is Gary, and I'm from Historic Mass County. I'm here to talk to the supervisor of the office and 800, and all the time the step buses were late from Turlock and Bethesda. And also I did talk to them about the times and problem the buses and somebody drink on the bus, the driver's not phone rules and nothing.
I guess I can ask the question. Where do you take the bus from? This is a busing issue?
Yeah.
And where do you take, where do you pick up the bus?
Gale Road and West Cottide and Turlock. And I take the bus all the way to the Route 10, Route 15, to all the way to the Asta.
Okay, and who'd you talk to down at the county? Did you call the Board of Supervisors? Did you call the Public Works Department?
The supervisor of the Stark office.
Okay, supervisor of the Stark office.
Yeah.
So what we can do is leave your name and number right here with our clerk of the board, and we will make sure someone from Stark that we deal with this issue.
Okay.
Okay?
Sorry.
What was your name again?
Gary.
Gary. Thanks, Gary.
I just wonder if I start getting out of here or something.
Okay, that is the only speaker I have for comment on public comment. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to address this board on a non-agenda item? Okay, seeing none, then we will move to the consent calendar. Does any member of this board wish to pull an item from consent calendar? Does any member of the audience wish to pull an item from consent calendar? Okay, seeing none, I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent calendar. Okay, there's been a motion to approve the consent calendar. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, motion's been made and seconded. And all those in favor of approving the consent calendar, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion's carried 5-0. We will now move to agenda item B8. Approval to accept the Real Estate Fraud Prosecution Trust Fund annual report. Good morning, Bergen.
Good morning, Chairman DeMartini, members of the board, Mr. Risen, and Mr. Doering. Bergen Flatiger, District Attorney. We are returning once again. It's our annual opportunity to present to the board a report from the Real Estate Fraud Prosecution Trust Fund, and we are waiting for that to get up on the screen. There we go. And I am here really just to kick it off and turn it over to the real experts on this subject. I would like to introduce to you Jeff Mangar, Deputy District Attorney. He is the prosecutor assigned to the unit. Investigator Glenn Gully is our criminal investigator and has been working in this area since, I want to say, 2006, a very long time. Gerard Hilgart is not here this morning. He also assists in that unit as one of our investigators. And Linnell Solomon is an investigative assistant with a lot of real estate experience, and so she helps keep the unit running smoothly. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Mangar.
Morning. Just going to give you a brief history about our unit, also tell you about some cases and convictions we've had this past fiscal year, as well as some pending cases that we have going. So first of all, we started with Senate Bill 537 that was passed in June 2005. $3 fee for specified real estate documents goes to the trust fund that funds this fraud investigation. Stanislaus County, we began our unit in January 2006, and then we became part of the FBI task force in 2009. Now, in our unit, we have a full-time deputy district attorney. Right now, that's myself. We have one criminal investigator, one part-time investigator, and one part-time investigative assistant. So our mission is to investigate and prosecute real estate fraud complaints at the state and federal level. We want to educate industry professionals, civic groups, and the public on current real estate fraud schemes and how to avoid becoming a victim of those schemes. This past fiscal year, we've gone and given 10 presentations to the public. We also work with specialized regulatory agencies such as the Bureau of Real Estate and the Bureau of Corporations regarding dishonest and unscrupulous industry professionals. And it's primarily those industry professionals that garner our attention just because of their position of trust that they're currently in and the amount of damage and fraud that they could inflict upon victims. So who really are the victims of loan fraud? Well, the banks acquired the bad loans from mortgage brokers and other lenders. The banks then sold the bad loans to Fannie and Freddie Mac. The loans were securitized and sold to investors, and the FDIC took over Fannie and Freddie in 2008. So the banks still service the loans, however, it's the taxpayers who really own these bad loans. People often think, well, it's the banks that own these loans and the banks are the victims, when in reality it's the taxpayers. So there is a difference between state and federal prosecution. We work closely with our federal agencies just because of the amount of punishment that defendants receive once they're prosecuted federally, and also the resources that the federal agencies have that unfortunately the local agencies do not. So also we send cases federally when there's a jurisdiction issue. Sometimes victims and witnesses and defendants are throughout California, throughout the United States, and even in other countries. In those type of situations, it's better to send those cases federally. Sometimes the size of the cases dictate whether or not a case stays locally or goes with federal prosecution. Some cases have hundreds, even thousands of victims. One of the cases you'll hear about today is a case in which there are over 1,300 victims. And we have to work together to investigate and prosecute these cases. So even though it starts out locally, we work with the feds when we bring upon a federal prosecution. Again, the feds could also help us with federal asset seizures, with accounting and computer forensics. And again, the sentences that the federal scheme provides is much greater than any type of local sentence that a defendant could receive, especially with the realignment issues. So for state prosecutions, we can investigate and begin prosecution much sooner and hopefully stop the suspects from continuing their crimes here in Stanislaus County. Unfortunately, with federal cases, it takes much longer to indict and investigate, sometimes years after a crime is committed. So that's some of the drawbacks between state versus federal prosecutions. Both state and federally prosecuted cases can also take years to conviction. So even though with a state case we could get an arrest immediately, it sometimes takes years before the case actually gets to trial. And again, we have state and federal cases from 2006 that are still in the court process. So at this time, I'm going to introduce investigator Glenn Goley, and he'll tell you about some of the agencies we work with, some of the convictions we've received this past year, as well as some of our pending cases.
Good morning, Glenn Goley. These are some of the agencies we work with. I always like to mention the Federal Housing Finance Agency. We have a very good relationship with this agency, and they help us out a lot. They investigate all Fannie, Freddie Mac fraud, and they have the resources to help, and they provide training for me at the federal level. The FBI, I work with the FBI, the IRS, the Department of Treasury, Franchise Tax Board. Stanislaus County Recorder's Office, fortunately, the recording of false documents seems to have come to a halt. Maybe it's from some of the prosecutions that we prosecuted six people, I think, six convictions last year for filing these false documents. The major banks are now cooperating more with law enforcement, and the reason they are, they've been hit with these big $10, $12, $20 million or $1 billion fines, so they're more willing to report some of this fraud to us now and cooperate more. The federal agencies are holding the banks accountable for these loans they originated or they sold, and I work with those agencies. Again, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, OIG, handles most of them. One of the issues, I think, is there's very few detectives really in law enforcement that work mortgage fraud. I've done this for 8 years. I've been everywhere. It seems like most of them at the state level, the detective position is an assignment rather than, you know, a request. For me, I love doing it, so it's what I have to do. Paradigm shift in law enforcement, I spoke about this before. I think that the courts need to hold these white-collar criminals more accountable for their actions. When you prosecute an auto thief or a burglar, they come in with a long track record of stealing cars, burglary, and they get sentenced according to their past criminal history. White-collar criminals normally do not have a criminal history, so they're treated accordingly, and they don't get sentenced to what they should, in my opinion. James Lee Lankford, you've heard me talk about him before. Owner, operator, broker, Apollo Realty, Century 21. He literally defrauded little old ladies out of their houses. He went from White Cliff to El Reno, Oklahoma, where he's in prison for 10 years. Sidney Sanchez, this was an interesting case. I spoke before about it. This is a case that originated in Modesto. We're going to play a clip here in a minute, and you won't be able to tell it from the clip, but this is a case that started in Modesto. It's probably 35 victims filing false documents to stall foreclosure, bankruptcy fraud. The U.S. Postal Service got a hold of the FBI and said they have some new agents that they would like to get trained on a big, convoluted real estate fraud scheme. So the FBI says, well, the guy to call is Glenn Gulley because he's always got some kind of convoluted scheme going on. So the Postal Service, which was really helped us here because this took a lot of investigation, took a lot of money, had to travel a lot. So by having them on board, they were able to really pick up the tab for a lot of this. Her name is Jewel Hinkles, you'll see on the clip. That's her real name. The first time she went to prison for white-collar crime, her name was Lorna Foe. Sidney Sanchez, what she uses here, she's using another name I've heard. So anyway, if you can play the video.
Scheme that targeted desperate homeowners fighting to avoid foreclosure. The woman behind the scheme is behind bars, but KCRA3's Mallory Hoff tells us the victims are still stuck with homes they can't sell.
Rafael Castillo was close to foreclosure on his Manteca home, so when a company called Save My Home said they could help, he signed up.
No, put on the
phone. He believed that he was modifying his loan, or an investor was going to buy his loan.
Castillo says a representative from Save My Home pressured him to sign paperwork quickly.
It was like something rushed, you know. You have to come into the office. You have to sign. If you don't sign, they're going to foreclose on your house.
Castillo did sign and agreed to pay $10,000 in installments to save my home. But there were no investors. Instead, the paperwork put this woman, Jill Hinkle's name, on the deed. Hinkle's had set up a network of companies with offices in Beverly Hills, Manteca, and Roseville, all part of a scheme to defraud desperate homeowners out of millions of dollars.
Part of Hinkle's scheme was to file bankruptcy in federal court, which stalled foreclosure proceedings, at least temporarily.
Hinkle filed for bankruptcy over and over again for each of the houses. KCRA3 has found 73 bankruptcy filings across the state. So many it caught the eye of federal prosecutors, who convicted Hinkle's on 16 counts of bankruptcy fraud and 8 counts of mail fraud.
This is certainly among the worst of these kind of cases that we've seen.
And now an even bigger problem still exists for her victims. Even though Hinkle's has been convicted, her victims cannot sell their homes because back when they signed all the paperwork, they were adding her name to the deed. And now each and every victim has to either ask Hinkle's to remove it voluntarily or hire a lawyer on their own and go to court and ask to have it removed.
Have the cycle of avenues, they could lose their homes while they wait.
They could. I certainly hope they don't. You know, another factor is that a lot of the victims in this case were financially precarious to begin with. There's something like 1,300 victims out there. I'm not sure how many properties.
He decided he wanted a short sale, but now he can't even short sell because she's on the deed.
Sarah Martinez is Rafael Castillo's real estate agent. She's tried to convince Jill Hinkle's to take her name off the deed, but Hinkle's refuses to sign the paperwork.
She tried to correct me and tell me that no, it's not supposed to read like this.
We came here to the Nevada County Correctional Facility hoping to speak with Jill Hinkle's. She refused to talk to us. Romney's office is asking the court to order Hinkle's to sign over the deeds before she can be released from prison. But the feds are asking for the maximum sentence, 5 years, meaning Hinkle's could wait that long to sign the deeds over. And most of her victims don't have that long to wait.
I just want my wife back. I just want her to sign the deed. As easy as it was to get her on the deed, you know, why isn't it that easy to get her off the deed?
In Stockton, Mallory Hoff, KCRA 3 News.
The U.S. attorney is writing letters for victims explaining that Hinkle's name was put on their title as part of the fraud, but that still doesn't take her name off of the deed. Hinkle's will be sentenced at the end of March.
This case actually created some, or may create some new legislation where all these phony documents, false documents have been filed to stall foreclosure, and then when it comes time to try to sell the house, title's clouded, and the legislation they're proposing would allow, with judicial review, for somebody like me to recommend to the judge that these documents be cleared from title, which would keep you from having a quiet title action or declaratory relief action or, you know, 2 or 3 years in court and $10,000-$15,000. So this was a mess. There's probably more than 1,300, but that's what the Areola, it's part of another scheme that originated here, went to San Bernardino. That case is still pending. I actually had a U.S. attorney from Miami, Florida call me yesterday, and they've got some of the same case going on there, so we're comparing notes. Erica Burge and Griselda Flores basically took money from the victims to buy a house, and In one case, bought the house in her name. In the other case, didn't buy the house at all. Griselda Flores, kind of an interesting. I go to the recorder's office to get a document related to this case. There's somebody in front of me. I hear the person in front of me ask for the same document I'm after. So it's the defendant. So she got to take a walk with me to the DA's office. Argelina Leyva, she's another one that she actually had like $400,000 loans on a country property in Oakdale, worked for $15 an hour, got a loan, never made any payments, stayed in the house, filed phony documents, and yeah, she finally, I told her to knock it off once and that wasn't good enough. A year later, it comes to my attention again, so she was charged, convicted, and left the house. The pending cases, we got a federal trial scheduled this spring for Modesto developer defrauded a family and tried to defraud the city of Modesto related to some municipal bonds. A state trial for a Modesto broker defrauding a land developer. All that land's kind of in the same area. We've got two more trials scheduled for the same defendant. One was where he defrauded a bunch of people from Salt Lake City, talked them into buying houses out here, and they all went to foreclosure, lost a lot of money. And then the other case, there's like 10 states on the East Coast, 28 developers of high-rise buildings, golf course, marinas. That's the one that goes all the way to Hong Kong. He told these developers he could loan them $11 billion with a B dollars. His problem was he went to the 10 states on the East Coast because he'd already done 5 years for a previous case that we had. So he was on the right track. He got completely out of Modesto, but he had all the money wired to McHenry Avenue Bank. So that's what got him back on the radar. The San Bernardino case, the AG, Attorney General, is going to handle this case. It's another one that started right here in Modesto, spreads. It goes from literally from San Diego to Miami, Florida. We anticipate 10 to 15 people being indicted this year, hopefully, and that case will be prosecuted in San Bernardino. I expect a federal indictment on an industry professional for short sale fraud in 2014. We have another major investigation, industry professionals, probably 50 plus properties, short sale fraud, bank fraud, mail fraud, wire fraud. And that's as fast as I could go. That kind of wraps it up. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the report. We've asked the board to accept the report, and if anyone has any questions, we've got the experts here who might be able to answer them.
Any questions from the board? Supervisor Chiesa.
I guess the criminals are getting more refined now, right? Is that pretty much what we're saying? That it's not the old recording, illegally recording documents?
No, they, you know, with each year it seems like there's a new scam, there's something new that comes up, and when you're dealing with the industry professionals, they obviously have some knowledge and insight into what's going on, so you shut down one avenue of fraud and they're going to look for another.
Is it typically someone finds this, or is it the clerk recorder's office? Where did most of these, how did we find out about most of these cases, or defrauded folks?
It started by the cases coming to me, and then I found them at the recorder's office, and then some of the workers at the recorder's office, they knew what I was looking for, so they started calling. You know, most real estate cases have some sort of document tied to it. So it's a combination of both. I mean, I'll get a case and know there's a document over there. Or these false deeds of trust, I mean, they were pretty wise to that. As soon as somebody came in to file one of those, they knew what it was, so they'd call me.
Yeah. Catching it before it's done rather than trying to reverse it after the action.
Cool.
Thank you.
I didn't have one comment. I mean, looking over the staff report, you have 57 cases, hundreds of victims. I think the monetary losses, it shows $172 million. That always strikes me as what a small unit that you have to take care of something like this. And this is worse than auto theft by far, with this amount of victims and the complexity of the cases. There's 57 ongoing cases. Have you ever thought about adding any people more to the unit? So you can kind of cut down on the backlog?
I have.
Glenn would definitely like some help. There is that opportunity, and I've discussed it with some of you going forward about applying to increase the fee on the recorded document, which might provide some additional funding for us to expand the unit. I don't want to do that until we see a little bit more that it's going well in other counties, number one. And number two, I want to make sure that we can fill those positions. This is a very, very specialized area, and we're very lucky to have Glenn. There's not a lot of folks out there, quite honestly, investigators who have the aptitude and interest to spend the amount of time digging through, you know, thousands and thousands of pages of documents. So we're on the lookout, and we've had some folks that are very helpful that kind of help us part-time. But if we're able to identify, in my view, a detective out there who has this kind of aptitude, then we'll be coming in definitely saying we need to get this guy. But we do need the additional resources in terms of a help with maybe forensic accountants, that kind of thing, because these cases are so massive. I will say that because we have a good partnership with the feds and with the state attorney general's office, we have been able to get some resources to help us with where we are right now. But do you have anything to add, Glenn?
Yes. You know, I told you I traveled around to the different district attorney's offices. I'm going to tell you that I work for the best district attorney's office and the best DA in the state. And I'm allowed to work these big cases, which what I try to do is there's so many cases that come in, I can't work them all. So I try to do what's best for the community and what's best for the economy. And these cases that come in are all multiple, normally, from 10 to thousands, where some of the other agencies might work, you know, much smaller cases. We're working much bigger cases with, and a lot more volume, with, you know, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, for example. So, kind of got off track a little bit, I guess, but we could use some help. But this is a job that you have to want to do, you know, and for 8 years I have loved to come to work, and the most law enforcement, you mentioned, well, I went to have a warrant signed one time, and the judge looked at it about the third page of the affidavit and said, what did you do to get this assignment? You know, it's like I'm being punished. So you have to find somebody who likes doing this, and, you know, if we find that right person, then, yeah, great.
They certainly do a good job on this. You know, not only the people that get caught in these scams and foreclosure rescues and loan modifications, they're defrauded, but the taxpayers on the hook for tens of millions of dollars just in this county alone. You do a good job there. You keep it up, maybe you can add a couple people to that unit.
We'd appreciate that. Thank you very much, and I did not pay him to say that.
Okay, any other questions of the board? Okay, we have two staff recommendations. Is there a motion to accept the staff recommendations?
Motion to approve. Accept.
Okay, motion's been made. Is there a second?
I will second it.
Okay, motion's been made and seconded to approve the two staff recommendations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, motion's carried 5-0. Okay, thank you for your report. Okay, we will now move to agenda item B9.
Interesting piece of irony, that topic moving into this topic. I did not strategize that. Good morning, Chairman DeMartini, members of the board, CEO Risen, Council Dong, Keith Boggs, Assistant Executive Officer. With me this morning are Jamie Eggers, the Director of Department of Environmental Resources, as well as Walter Ward, your County Water Manager. The item before you this morning is a staff request to consider a pilot program for domestic water well relief. This has truly been a team effort. I would like to thank and acknowledge Supervisors O'Brien and Withrow, CEO Risen, Council Dong, Lauren Klein, and Kashmir Gill in the Auditor Controller's Office, Ms. Chumley and Ms. Vasquez in the CEO's Office. It has been a team sport. This is an epitome of creativity in crisis, and I thank each of you for your clever and can-do spirit in bringing this pilot forward in such short order. While each of you know the crisis environment we're in regarding groundwater availability, I'd like to take just a moment to summarize our status to date. Calendar year 2013 is now officially on record as the driest year in our state's history, and with little relief in sight, it's time to take some near-term action to to align and complement the efforts that your board has set in place to deal with this issue in the midterm and in the long range. In January of this year, the governor proclaimed a state of emergency regarding water availability and drought in California. To that end, and with your leadership, you moved quickly to invest and hire a groundwater manager to provide us with a technical voice in these increasingly critical regional discussions. You formed a water advisory committee comprised of representative cross-section of our community along with a technical advisory as support to develop a five-year strategy for connecting all of the regional good works and to ensure that those light areas historically overlooked are all considered in this planning strategy. Within 100 days, which is still quite amazing to me, the Water Advisory Committee returned to you with a five-year strategy that outlined 19 near-term and mid-term action items that our region must achieve in order for us to maintain, secure, and protect our precious water resource for today and for future generations to come. But as the Water Advisory and all of our regional partners from water districts to city jurisdictions work toward a regional governance consistent with the direction being dictated by the state of California, we need to also seek out immediate assistance strategies that can be applied to the growing number of local domestic residential well owners experiencing dry well conditions. And as the staff report before you this morning states, to help alleviate these concerns in the near term. There are programs in existence, but as staff searched for something that could assist our region, we recognized early on that the assistance available were targeted for small water districts primarily and in very limited capacity for the very poor. The USDA program guidelines for domestic residential assistance require the homeowner must be 62 years or older, have an annual income less than $21,000 a year, and their home or their residence less than 1,800 square feet in size. These guidelines are extremely limiting, and while a reasonable option for those who meet this eligibility, will simply not provide assistance for the average middle-class homeowner, the employed blue-collar resident of working age in our rural communities. So to that end, we offer the following pilot loan program for your consideration. Our intention, first and foremost, is to keep the program simple and agile, flexible and applicable to as many Stanislaus County unincorporated residents as possible. The eligibility requirements as stated on screen. First, eligible applicants will be unincorporated, owner-occupied residential parcels. Applicants may have a combined total household income not to exceed 170% of the median household income Stanislaus County. That would equate to $94,432 gross income. And the median household income in Stanislaus County is $55,548. An elder preference will be given to those 65 years of age and older on a fixed income. And what I mean by that preference also, if 10 applications come in and applications 7, 8, and 10 happen to be 65 years or older on a fixed income, 7 would become 1, 8 would become 2, and 10 would become 3. Reshuffling. This is a first-come, first-served program defined by an appropriately completed application and providing all requested information and documentation, not simply initial inquiry. A complete application would determine your queue status. Total secured debt on the property, including the loan amount requested in the application process, cannot exceed a total debt-to-value ratio of 80%, and the burden of that proof, the application meets this total debt-to-value ratio, rests entirely on the applicant. In meeting the burden of proof, the county is willing to consider appraisals done within the past year by a qualified appraisal, assessor Proposition 8 valuations, or other forms of information that clearly support the current value of the property. And finally, all applicants must have reasonable credit histories demonstrating a minimum credit score of 650. The terms of this pilot program are equally straightforward. Loans under the program would be approved as part of the county's Economic Development Bank revolving loan program and subject to a simple interest rate of 1% based upon outstanding quarterly principal balance. All loans would require the landowner to sign a promissory note secured by a recorded lien, deed of trust, or similar instrument. Loans would be paid within 5 to 7 years, if depending upon financial hardship at application review and approval. There would be no prepayment penalty. A late fee will be applied to past due payments. And I've had some conversation with this client, our auditor controller. She's recommended perhaps using a flat rate, $25 per late instance, with a 10 calendar day grace period pre-penalty. Liens on property would be released upon loan satisfaction. The county would retain the services of a local title company to assist with document preparation and recording, title searches as needed, and issuing of title insurance. And all fees due to title company for such services would be added to the total loan amount. Regarding loan program standards, the emergency loan program only applies to verifiable rural domestic well failure situations. This is not a preventative measure. The program cannot be used for unreasonable well upgrades or pump improvement projects beyond what is reasonably necessary to maintain a potable water supply. The program is for residential, owner-occupied applicants only. No loans will be approved for retroactive water well repairs. All applications would be submitted to the Department of Environmental Resources, DER. Once applications are received, the application will be reviewed for completeness and the applicant will be contacted for any necessary follow-up of additional information. It is only at full application completion that an application will be considered and in the queue for possible approval, as I mentioned before. The review process will be determined by a special committee consisting of one member of your County Board of Supervisors for your determination, the Water Resources Manager, the Chief Executive Officer or his designee, and the Auditor Controller or her designee. In the event that the Water Resource Manager is unavailable and on assignment, we recommend that the Director of Environmental Resources serve as alternate to the Water Resource Manager in his absence. So that is the essence of this pilot program. Should you approve to move forward with this intervention, we have several recommendations for you to consider this morning. First, review and adopt the Emergency Domestic Well Financial Assistance Pilot Program and direct staff to implement the program at the very soonest practical date. That may take us a few weeks, gentlemen, to final any changes you may recommend this morning, final the application process, and make the program available on the DER Water Resources website. And approve the use of $200,000 of Economic Development Bank fund balance to implement the program. And this concludes a brief summary of this pilot initiative. Again, this has been a collective effort that has encompassed multiple staff from several departments and disciplines, and we all welcome your thoughts, comments, edits, concerns, and of course, your revisions.
Supervisor O'Brien.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I just want to take an opportunity, first of all, to thank staff for all their hard work on this. I know they spent countless hours working on this to address different areas of the drought, so I just appreciate that. I'm very much in support of this program, and just want to throw out a couple different ideas to see if there's any interest from the board. One would be the 170% of the median income. Whether or not that's too high, maybe should drop a little. So I'd be open to hearing suggestions on that. And then the other concern that's out there is the potential of credit scores being requiring it to be too high. And maybe there's some sort of matrix or formula that the more equity you have in your property, the lower your score could be. I know what the goal is, and I'm very much supportive of the goal, and that's protect taxpayer money to make sure this money comes back to the county and their taxpayers. And so I understand and very much support the protection we have, but maybe there's a matrix we can look at. So just ideas, is just see what the temperature of the board is on it.
Supervisor Mantis. I too want to commend you on addressing this challenge that we have, and I believe that many of the suggestions that Supervisor O'Brien has recommended, I support quite clearly. There's one additional term that perhaps I'd like to see put in there, is that each loan would be capped at $20,000 because we have limited money. Also, in that money, would be the title, would be fees and et cetera. So if it works within the $20,000, but I believe it would be beneficial to cap it at $20,000. We'd have a better turnover.
Thank you, Supervisor Chiesa.
This is perfect. This is a working document right here. I would, you know, we asked staff to do something, and what, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, we have a program. We have the outline of a program. I have to agree with Supervisor O'Brien's comments that the 170% is too high. I think we're better off to broaden it, to make it a little easier for lower income to hit a more of a sweet spot. I'm not exactly sure where that is, but around the median income, maybe just a little over the median income, I think is fair. And I really like the idea about the sliding scale, because 650 is probably, some folks might have issues. If the loan to value, and they're not close to being upside down, we should be able to lower that, especially if we take a lien on the property, if we're secured, because paying the taxpayer, we're using taxpayer money, so that is an absolute that we protect that. And I thought that was a great suggestion about capping it at $20,000, and I'm in complete agreement on that. So just some changes, lowering, and again, I'm willing to move it around, but lowering what we consider to be the cap on income.
Well, Mr. Razin, thank you. Great suggestions, Board. First of all, staff has no concerns at all with a cap, so I think that would be a good idea to include a cap. The credit score in a couple articles in the paper that's shown up to be a potential a barrier or hindrance to access to this program. And so I reached out earlier this morning to see how we handle some of our low-income assistance, down payment assistance programs, and talked to our planning staff, and they not only do we not look at credit scores, but they're not aware of any agencies that do per se. They look at more a total debt limit of around 43%, so that's one particular option. The other thing, staff, we tried to steer clear of putting subjective criteria in. The reality is in the down payment assistance program, there is some level of subjectivity that goes into each analysis, and so if you wanted to make this more subjective in nature based on, we do have a committee that would be composed of a board member and CEO rep and the water manager. It seemed like there was one other, the auditor controller. So you could leave, you know, just remove the credit score and leave some demonstration requirement in if you wanted to make it more subjective. Otherwise, I would recommend maybe something more like a 43% total debt limit or something, so we know they have the capacity to pay it back.
And I will say that in some of our down payment assistance programs, those were us operating on federal funds.
Right.
This is Stanislaus County's money, and we have to make sure that Stanislaus County's money gets paid back to Stanislaus County.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have to be a little more cautious. Than
one other thought on the median income, in talking with planning staff this morning, there's different kind of sweet spots for different programs. So the feds have this very low income that hardly anybody can meet kind of threshold, but we became aware that the home program provides some opportunity, and it's a little more complicated and a little more strings attached, but for people up to 80% of median income that could include a well component. So, you know, you may want to think about, you know, what group of people may be between that 80% of median income, or wherever you feel comfortable, 120, 150, whatever it is, you know, having a program for them, because there may be some tools available for people under 80% of median income.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ransom. Supervisor Withrow.
First of all, those are all great. So first, I want to thank staff. I know this was again, as we've said here, it was, you guys threw this whole thing together in a couple of weeks. Our reaction time has been great. We've been light on our feet throughout this whole process, even with the entire Water Advisory Committee. The speed at which we're moving is great. So thank you guys for doing this. And all these suggestions I'm good with. Wherever we go with that, I think this is great. It'll be interesting to see the number of applicants that we get. If we're going to come up with a $20,000 limit here, that's 10 that we're going to approve. And so we'll see. If we get to 10 immediately, we'll have to look and see if we need to expand that, if we've got 50 applicants there. So I think that part's great. And I think, again, this is a basic service that government needs to provide. We're just assisting here. We're not handing out money. We're assisting. It expects to be paid back, as we've talked about. So I think that's all great. So the other comment I wanted to make is just about 2 weeks ago, I think we met with all the well drillers. And all the well drillers, I think the largest well drillers in this county. And we sat down and worked with them just to try to find out where they were in this process and the delays that everybody's having to deal with right now. And I kind of walked out of there, I think we all were kind of feeling good that these guys are doing everything they can to get to these. So we've got two issues here. One is the financing to pay for the well, and the other is how soon can it get done. And these guys are working on the side of how soon can it get done. And it was a good feeling for us to see that they're working with each other. They're sending referrals back and forth amongst each other to try to service everybody who's in need out there, everybody who's without water. So we've got a good group of well drillers out there who are doing good things for our community, trying to make this get us through this problem that we're dealing with right now. So I'm good with all this stuff, guys. All these suggestions, I think these are good things and tweaks that we can make to this. And I really appreciate staff getting this going so quick.
Okay, I'm going to open it up to the public. I do have one speaker card on this issue, Pam Vieira.
First of all, I want to thank you for trying to help people like us who are middle income, senior citizens living on a fixed income, worked all of our lives. Never have asked for a thing. We're not asking for any handout. We just want a low interest loan so we could have water, which is a necessity, not a luxury. All around us, I live in Denair, all around us, wells are going dry every day. None of us qualified for anything else. Through that one assistant program that this gentleman was talking about, the first question they asked me is if I had a swimming pool. Not the size of my house, not my income, nothing. If I had a swimming pool, that disqualified us. Even though the swimming pool's 35 years old, and it's a great source of water in case we have a fire, and it's a good place if your well goes dry, and you need to get wet, which we have had to do. Then when irrigation around us stops, then the water comes up. Our water has been as brown as if you had the flu, diarrhea, and it's full of sand. And it's been getting worse and worse and worse, and we have conserved water for years. My question is, and most of you did address a lot of it, was the 650 credit score. The last 8 years have been economically hard on everybody. There's probably not a person anywhere that hasn't been laid on something. Most of us don't have an extra $20,000. We've had the well drillers out. That's about what it will take for us to have to go down to 300 feet. Our well now is at 104 feet. We need you to look at it by a case by case. My husband a few years ago was critically, critically ill. He was at Stanford for 7 to 8 months. He wasn't able to work. That's when we got upside down. So I would like you to take all of that into consideration when you're looking at an application. And I thank you for working hard because we barely have any water.
Have you got an estimate from anybody on what it would cost
yeah.
to repair your problem?
Yes, it's about $20,000. Mm-hmm. And we're on an 8-month waiting list.
Wow.
Yeah. So we've had foster pumps out, and we've done everything. We were told to send an application in for this Prop 84. I did all of that. A very nice gentleman from Sacramento called me and said it wasn't for individual domestic well owners. It was for more like the city of Turlock or people like that. We have tried. I've tried everything. And day by day, it gets a little more critical and a little more critical. And we live on an acre. I mean, I'm not farming with it. I'm just living with it. And we've lived there for 37 years. And we don't want to move. We couldn't sell because there's no water. So I appreciate what you guys are doing, and we're hoping you can help people like us.
Are you close enough to the town of Denair where they can hook up your house?
No. We are past the S-curve, heading towards Turlock Lake. No, we cannot.
Yeah,
look up. I know. I've asked.
Time's left.
They all, Denaro, we're small. We've lived out there 53 years. If we could have, we would have. But we can't.
Okay. Well, I was just curious.
Yeah. Thank
Sometimes
you.
Out of service connections are allowed in certain instances.
Yeah. Thank you.
Would anybody else from the public like to address this board? Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Board of Supervisors, and CEO Risen. I'm Larry Potomo with California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation, and I'm glad to hear you're having this program as a pilot here in the county, because I think this is probably the first of its kind. I haven't heard this going on in other communities. So the need is there. So I think you're looking at how does this fit the need that is emerging here in this community or has become a crisis now. You have the federal program you mentioned, but you didn't mention the state programs. It was the lady who mentioned the Prop 84 money. So in terms of what is the county doing, we're developing a list for the disadvantaged communities, those small connections, 5 to 15, who can be eligible for that funding. And so she may not be able to connect to it, but other communities may, and so that's free money. So there's a list of what those disadvantaged communities are in the county, where they can meet the needs of those residents, so that you can see where the Fed, where the state, and the Water Resources Board, and yourselves are meeting. So I think what you're trying to do is align where you have unmet need here. So I congratulate you on your doing that. So I think the other thing is, and you said it, your government, you should help, not hurt. So you heard the comment about what to do to recommendations to make it easier. You want to be flexible and agile. It's probably a little bit more complex than that, because you have all this stuff going on behind the scenes, departments involved, you're going to try and get liens and promissory notes and all that going on. And so you're going to ask the community to go through this process. So really look at it as a case-by-case basis, as the person said, and also look at an appeal process or reconsideration process should someone be denied, because you want to create access, not additional barriers. So with that, also some community education and outreach. So you're getting to the people that really need it, because there might be some people not coming forward. And if there's some hard-to-reach communities who may not be listening or reading the paper, that may live on land, that may be owner-occupied, but they live on it and their well's done. So keep attention to those people. It could be farm workers. It could be really low-income people kind of isolated and hidden from our view. And then we also want to understand that this is a health and safety issue across the board, regardless of who people are, because that's what we want to do is help and not hurt. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Anybody else in the audience like to address this board on this issue?
Hi, Glenn Gulley again. My son, daughter, and I all live within a mile and a half of each other, close to Joe Perez, right in the middle of where all the wells are going dry. And it is a really scary feeling when your wells are going dry. And I can tell you, I did not feel any better about any of this until I talked to Mr. O'Brien And I really want to thank Mr. O'Brien. It just makes you feel better. And if there's anything that you can do to expedite getting the wells drilled, you know, there's nothing I can say that you haven't heard already, but it sounds like maybe the ag wells are getting priority, and if you can do something to help the people that have no water or are just about out of no water, out of any water, it would be a big deal. Thank you very much.
Glenn, if I could just, that was what this meeting was about that we had a couple of weeks ago with all the well drillers, and I can tell you that we felt comfortable that it wasn't just the ag wells that were getting a priority. I mean, these people realize how important this is, and if anything, they're trying to, and a lot of the farmers are, saying, stop here, go ahead and take care of that one if you need to. So a lot of that is going on. So it's not, I know this is perception out there that the farmers, the ag wells are just getting, but I can tell you that's not the case, and we were assured of that a couple of weeks ago. That was the purpose of bringing everybody together, because that was our first concern. Is that what's going on here? And that's not what's going on here. These people are going out of their way to take care of the domestic wells as quick as they can.
Actually, Sean Roddy came by and gave some hope, too. My son's well is just about done, and he's not completely out of water, but his neighbor is completely out of water. There's about five right in the same area that are either dry or going to be dry pretty quick.
Yeah, Sean was in on that meeting. He's on our water advisory committee. Yeah, so we're, there should be some assurance for you that we are working very hard, and they are working very hard to get to these domestic wells. So
yeah, I felt better after talking to Sean, and I really felt better after talking to Mr. O'Brien that, you know, something was going to happen. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. Is there anybody else who'd like to address the board on this issue? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the board for a decision. I'd like to make a few comments before we get started. I think this program is certainly needed, and I really thank the staff for putting this together as quickly as they have. This is an emergency situation for a lot of folks out there. I would like to just make a few comments just in general about this program. First of all, the cap that Supervisor Monteith proposed, I really agree with that. We have to have some limit to how much that we could loan somebody. There's only so much money to go around. And I think a $20,000 cap is would be more than sufficient. The preference to seniors on fixed income, 65 and over, I think would be something that we should do. Loan to value is also something I think we could look at, too. How much equity a person has in the property should have some bearing on it. And I do think that 170% of the median income is a little bit high. I think, in my estimation, it should be cut to 120 or 150% of the median income. The median income is already, it's over $55,000. So that's just my thoughts. So I'm going to hammer out something that we can all agree with here. Supervisor O'Brien.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, first of all, if I can just give an update on the well drilling. Again, our staff has taken the lead, actually in the state of California, to push Air Resources Board to allow some of the well drilling rigs that are used in other states into California to get the backlog of wells drilled. Worked with our local air district, San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District, and found provisions in emergency law that allow that to occur with specific type of engines. What we've also learned through this process is those specific type engines are not usually used in the valley. Different soil types use different kind of equipment to drill wells. Within the past week, we have gotten unofficial word, and I don't think it's official yet, but that Air Resources Board will allow these drilling rigs that are used in the valley, they're a PTO-driven engine, to be used. And so that portion was not in the emergency regulations, but they're going to add it to it. And that's great news for the valley. And I think most, if not all, of our drillers know this information, so hopefully we'll see some new equipment come into the valley and get this backlog going. On Thursday, San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District voted to set aside $500,000 to mitigate any air pollution that these new rigs emit. They're not up to California code on air emissions, and so we're using some of our fund balance from the air district to mitigate any air pollution that occurs from that. So that way there won't be any environmental challenges on it. So that's good news. And last thing I want to just mention is this is not the end all. This is not the solution. This is just another step we're taking in this drought situation. And again, I want to thank staff. And Mr. Chairman, if you're ready, I'll try a motion or try some amendments, and maybe we can talk about it. Maybe we can get this passed today, and so that way we can get rolling with this program.
And why don't you throw out some recommendations there, and we'll see if let's talk about those.
Okay, I have four amendments I'd like to try. First of all, the amendment to the applicant income not to exceed 150% of family or household medium income. Next amendment I'd like to try is to add the cap of $20,000 per loan with fees included. Third amendment would be to eliminate requirement for minimum credit score, leave it to the committee to evaluate credit worthiness with the model of the 43% total debt as used in other governmental programs. And then the fourth amendment is we have a, one of our members on the board is really the head of the water crisis, and I would recommend that we nominate him to this committee, and that would be Supervisor Withrow.
Okay. And usually the chair would appoint somebody, so Withrow, how do you
think? With the chair, not even current.
Another committee. So I'm good with all of those. Thanks, Bill, except for maybe the last one. But one other thing I'd like to see if we could add possibly is that we might need to come back here. If we blow through the $200,000 in a week, I want to somehow leave us the ability to come back here again and talk about some more money from the economic bank. So just
could I recommend perhaps, since we're coming up on our second 100-day update, that as part of that update, that we share with you the status of this program?
Perfect. Okay. That's great.
Well, we're not really sure how much demand there's going to be for this, but certainly if it exceeds what we expect, it could be increased quite quickly. Supervisor Kiesa.
Yeah, I just wanted to also add that I agree with Supervisor Withrow, but also the median income, I'm okay right now with 150%, but that's something we might have to look at if there's an overwhelming demand of lowering that also. And we'll kind of track other people are coming in on that, and that might be a way of, you know, again, narrowing the box. So I'm okay with all those recommendations, and again, with the chairman's concurrence, I would like to see Supervisor Withrow on there.
And any other comments from the board? Hey, Supervisor O'Brien, go ahead with that motion.
Okay, you want me to restate? Okay. I will leave out the Putting Terry on here because the chairman's correct. It's chairman's prerogative, so I'll leave that up to our chairman. Make a motion to approve this program as outlined today with the following amendments. Amendment number one, change the applicant income not to exceed 150% of household medium income. Amendment number two, eliminate requirement for minimum credit score, leave it to committee to evaluate creditworthiness with a model of 43% total debt as used in other governmental programs. And amendment number three, add a cap of $20,000 per loan, inclusive of all fees.
Okay, you've all heard the motion. Is there a second?
Second.
And motion's made and second. Is there any further discussion or comments? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion's carried 5-0. Okay, we will now go to correspondence.
This board has received information from the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District regarding grant opportunities for public agencies to install infrastructure for alternative fuel and electric vehicles.
Referred to the Chief Executive Office and the General Services Agency.
This board has received a letter from the State of California Fish and Game Commission regarding proposed regulatory action related to salmon fishing.
Refer to the Fish and Wildlife Committee.
This board has received the claims as noted on the agenda.
Acknowledge receipt of claims and refer to the Chief Executive Office Risk Management Division. Are there any Board of Supervisors reports? Board very quiet today. Well, I'll just mention that we did have that Health Summit in Newman last week in the Biggest Loser contest, number 6. And we had that the most attended summit we've ever had this year with 8 teams. When we first started, we had 3 teams. So I'm one of the team members there, so I'm watching very carefully what I eat for the next 2 months. Also, I would like to mention that the dialysis center that was put in at Keystone Park is now open. It is the first dialysis center on the west side ever, and it's something that was badly needed. I would like to commend Keystone for putting up the money and doing this all on their own. For people that are on dialysis from Bernalas to Gustine, there is no place to go except for Turlock and Modesto. It's going to be a great convenience for them. Legislative and fiscal management report, Mr. Risen.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman. This Sunday is the last day for our state legislature to pass bills during regular session, and we anticipate that they will go into final recess once they adjourn. There's a big push here in the last days around groundwater, so our water manager will continue to watch that closely, and we'll let you know of how that comes out. Also wanted to report that your board had previously requested that we also be working on a draft contingency plan in the event of a failure of a small water system. Our emergency services director has been working with his division on that, and briefings have been scheduled to go over those with you as a board. So I just wanted to let the public know that that has not been lost on staff, that we've made good progress, and we will be briefing the board. That concludes my report.
We will now adjourn to closed session. Mr. Doring?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We have conference with labor negotiator this morning pursuant to Government Code Section 54957.6. The agency negotiators are Stan Risen, Nancy Bronstein, and Jody Hayes. The labor organizations are those listed on the agenda. Additionally, we have a conference with legal counsel to discuss existing litigation pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9, Subdivision D1. This involves one case, Marguerite Weisskopf versus Stanislaus County et al., Stanislaus County Superior Court, case number 672582. Do not expect a report out on either of these matters.
Is there any public comment on the closed session? Okay, seeing none, this meeting stands adjourned.